This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Dr. Max Zamilov, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Well, thank you for having me.
No, listen, it's a great pleasure. I saw you on Danny Jones's show, and I know that you know the work of Ben van Kirkwijk and Chris Dunn. And Chris Dunn was, well, both of them were on my show also. And have you been to my side of the pond? I'm in South Africa.
No, I have never been to Africa, and I really want to go to Egypt, obviously, but just haven't gotten a lot of it.
Egypt is technically Africa, but it kind of isn't.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You really need to go like to sub-Saharan Africa, I think, to experience Africa for real, because, you know, Mediterranean is more like a Roman, you know, Greek, European influence than anything else, I'd say.
What is your background?
Well, my background is in physics, so physics and computer engineering. So I got my master's and PhD from Moscow Institute of Electronic Engineering. And I studied at the University of Tulsa, and then I taught at Penn State for 8 years. I taught software engineering at Penn State. But I always was interested in physics, and, you know, that's where my research is concentrated, is in the physics and engineering side of things. And, you know, throughout my life, I had, you know, startups, and I worked on projects, and all of it is either nuclear engineering or petroleum engineering, or some kind of, you know, science/engineering. And of course, now I'm working on nuclear fusion, and that is, you know, my interest, my background, I would say, you know, my core competency. And somehow along the lines, I've gotten sucked into this, you know, alternative archaeology or alternative history community. And of course, you know, once you go in, there is no way you can back out of it, because it's just so interesting.
I mean, you were building a nuclear reactor in your basement. Is that true?
Yeah, in fact, you can see it in the background of this video. I don't really have a basement because I live in Florida, and basements in Florida would be like swimming pools. But this is my lab that you see, and this is you know, one of the reactors I'm working on, and I'm building two more in the garage. So I decided to move a bit more, let's say, adventurous type designs into garage, where it will be easier to deal if an oil spills or fire catches on. So I'm ramping up my game.
But how have the authorities not come after you?
Well, they have, now that you're asking. But I'm not breaking any laws or violating any regulations. And I do have some nuclear materials, you know, like this one under license. So you'd be amazed, you know, what you can do in United States, thank God. Because, you know, like in Europe, any kind of radioactive material, oh, no, you know, you cannot have it. But in U.S., fortunately, most materials you can possess in small quantities, which is called, I forget the regulation number, but basically it means if the quantity is beyond the threshold, it is considered harmless, and you can even mail it like in a regular envelope, you know, without any warning labels. You just put it, you know, that's how I buy them from suppliers. I just go to Oak Ridge Lab and I say, I need these isotopes, and they mail them to me. And once the activity goes above like certain limit, then you need license. So for this guy, I have a license, and once it goes more, you know, you get a different kind of license that requires inspections and whatnot. So it's a little bit of bureaucracy, but it's not overwhelming. So that's why I kind of like it here.
Yeah, you grew up in the Soviet Union. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. I was born and raised in Soviet Union. So I was born in Smolensk, and I went to school in Moscow. And when I graduated, you know, Soviet Union was no more. So I moved to the United States because I couldn't imagine myself living in the country that was going through, by all intents and purposes, was a, you know, civil war. It wasn't like as bad as the Balkans, but it was pretty bad as far as crime, corruption, and economic decay, and it was just unlivable. So I moved to US.
Economic decay? Oh, you amateurs! You haven't been to Africa.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, excuse me, but that's kind of a joke that you know, people who left Russia say, oh, you know, Putin was trying to turn Russia into Nigeria. And darn, you know, he succeeded. Oh, you can argue, you know, he didn't. So the people were arguing whether or not he succeeded. But, you know, Nigeria was kind of like a benchmark for a lot of, you know, Russian immigrants when they were discussing, you know, Russia. And I kind of thought that sounded ridiculous. But now that I look at it, probably the scale of corruption. So like Yoda says, much to learn, you still have. You know, that's what you could address to Russian government in terms of how corrupt they could be still. But anyway.
Yeah, so I mentioned at the beginning of our chat that Ben van Kirkwijk has been on my show, and he spoke about history being cyclical. And of course, he's done a lot of work on ancient Egyptian vases, which are remarkable in terms of the technology required to produce them. And Chris Dunn has also been on my show to talk about the pyramids, particularly the Great Pyramid itself being a power plant.
Well, I would say I partially align myself with the you know, thesis that they put forth, but I emphasize the word partially because I'd like to draw an important distinction. You know, what Ben and Chris Dunn are, you know, speaking of publicly is you know, nothing short of speculation, and I would like to be clear in our, you know, discussion that, you know, it's okay to be creative and it's okay to fantasize. But we kind of have to distinguish what our fantasies are and what are the facts that we actually know. So I would say that, you know, a lot of alternative, you know, historians or amateur archaeologists, they get so lost in these fantasies that they start, you know, treating them as facts. And, you know, when I come in on shows and I usually say, you know, I like to fantasize about what could have been in the past, or what, you know, pyramids could have been. But I don't want to present this as a fact because we don't know what has been in the past, right? We don't know, you know, everything about pyramids. So with that in mind, I would say it's a fascinating hypothesis that our past was cyclical because, you know, when you look back, surely I'd like to see more than, you know, primitive hairy beasts. You know, I'd like to see, you know, something like Atlantis, or I'd like to see intelligent, you know, creatures like dinosaurs, you know, flying in flying saucers and, you know, conquering stars, because that is exciting to see. What is not exciting to see is a bunch of naked hairy beasts, you know, chasing a mammoth. You know, that's kind of boring, right? So that's the picture we see in every museum. But, you know, whether that was the case, you know, I don't know, but where I agree with Ben and Chris Dunn, that we have to explore things like this. So that's the thing, you know, I don't like about mainstream scientific approach, which I learned kind of, you know, the hard way, and forgive me for taking a long time to answer. But, you know, when I was defending my dissertation, my father-in-law, he was my professor, and he told me, your defense and your dissertation must be boring, because the minute it provokes excitement will be, you know, the minute you fail at your defense. You will not pass. And unfortunately, that's how science, you know, carries itself. The research has to be boring, because if it's not boring, you know, people will argue and you will not be able to publish, and you will not be able to present your work. Because unfortunately, science is a competition of egos. It's all about, you know, being the smartest person, not about being the one who knows the truth. So that's why, you know, I left academia, because I feel like it's easier for me to pursue my, you know, diverse research interests on my own. But that's the answer.
Yeah, but I mean, it sounds like you're quite disillusioned with a mainstream science. I mean, that's understandable, yeah. Though. It seems like it's completely broken.
It is, and I'm, you know, quite disillusioned with everything, in fact. I'm disillusioned with mainstream science, and I'm disillusioned with alternative science. Yeah, and you know what's common between mainstream science and alternative science? The common factor is people. You know, people are the same. It's just, you know, you take this pie and you cut it in half, and you say, you know, this side is mainstream and this side is an alternative. Then you close your eyes, you turn the pie a few times, you look at it, and you cannot tell one side from the other. You know, none is better. It's, you know, same flawed people. You know, God created us flawed. So however you partition the system, it remains the same. And that's why I am, focusing, or at least, you know, trying to conduct myself in a way, you know, I want everyone to conduct themselves in the field. You know, just, report your findings truthfully and honestly. You know, if you made a mistake, admit it. And in science, you know, we always make mistakes. Because, you know, we never know the truth. And the only way, you know, to make progress is to make a hypothesis, you know, test it. If it works, great. If it doesn't, admit it doesn't work, you know, formulate another hypothesis. And in this matter, you know, hopefully we get closer to the truth.
But the problem when it comes to the pyramids is that it was so long ago that nobody knows what's going on. I mean, everything is speculation.
I would say that's only partially true because, you know, there are historical records. And once again, I'm not an archaeologist or historian, so I cannot speak, you know, with authority on this subject. You know, I studied only like a tiny, you know, slither of history that pertained to the stone vessels. But from my understanding is, you know, there are records pertaining, you know, to pyramids. They may not be, you know, complete and explicit or maybe, you know, fully understood. You know, but you know, there are historical documents that mention them and mention the construction process. So I encourage everyone who really, you know, wants to crack the mystery of pyramids, study all available archaeological and historical evidence. So it's not sufficient to go by, you know, what people on YouTube are saying, because, you know, that's another thing we got to understand. The purpose of YouTube is entertainment. So people have channels and develop following, you know, for the sake of entertainment. Or, you know, your show exists for the sake of entertainment. You know, all shows are like that, and that's fine, you know. But, you know, scientists, let's say, in theory, you know, work because they want to discover the truth. I know that's not the case, but at least, you know, the mission is different. So you cannot blame, you know, YouTube for, you know, putting forth, you know, speculative ideas or, you know, making reels that are interesting, but not factual. But, you know, yet, you know, if you really want to determine the truth, you got to sift through, you know, the myths and, you know, misrepresentations and whatnot, and really get to the facts. And if you want to get to the facts, you have to study, you know, the academic, you know, body of literature, because that goes, you know, down centuries, you know, all the way to Herodotus and all of the other literature that survived. And that's what you really got to study in order to know, you know, what is known about pyramids. You know, I have not done that work, so I cannot speak of it. Because speculating about, you know, pyramids being a power plant is much more fun, you know, than studying historical documents.
But I mean, you say that, but I was taught in school, official curriculum, that the pyramids were built by slaves and they were tombs.
Yeah, I would agree with you that that sounds like total bullshit, and I entirely don't buy, you know, this view. Except that it probably, you know, was built by slaves, because, you know, back then, the slaves was the only labor force available. So I would probably agree that it was built by slaves. I don't know how, and they're certainly not tombs, or at least, you know, the Great Pyramids of Giza are not tombs. So that I don't agree with. You know, some other pyramids somewhere else, you know, might have been, but Great Pyramids of Giza, I say it's inconsistent with the idea of them being tombs, because I see no evidence of that.
But what do you see evidence of?
Well, I will speak of it as an engineer. And once again, you know, I have not studied the scientific literature pertaining to the history of pyramids, so I could be, you know, making misstatements or whatnot. But, you know, when I look at pyramids, I mean, to me as an engineer, you know, they look like engineering or industrial fixtures. And I'm talking about, you know, the Great Pyramids of Giza, obviously. And I'm talking about, you know, the other, you know, three or four prominent pyramids, like, you know, the Red Pyramid or the Step Pyramid of Djoser. And there is like one more. So there is a like a short list of, you know, pyramids that are unique and exhibit this, you know, industrial qualities to them, as opposed to, you know, the greater body or greater variety of pyramids, you know, many either already decayed completely or appear a lot more primitive than this, like fine examples. So to me, as an engineer, you know, they look like some, you know, engineering facilities, and we can speculate whether it was a power plant or a chemical plant. And the principal problem that I see is because so much time has passed and so much looting took place, it's next to impossible to figure out what that was, because what we see is just a shell of what once was. And I'll give you an example. You know, I buy and sell a lot of equipment on eBay, and sometimes I buy a scientific instrument, and when it arrives, is just an enclosure. You know, it's just an enclosure of the instrument, and, you know, when you look at it, it looks like the instrument. But, you know, when you open it up, it's like all hollow. And you see these compartments and openings and holes and whatnot, and nothing in it. And, of course, because I bought the instrument, I know what it was, and I know what was inside. But in the case of pyramid, of the Great Pyramids, I think what we see is this enclosure that's, you know, through the millennia was stripped of its content, and we have no idea what was in it. So let me turn this off, sorry. My phone is ringing. So that's, I think, the principal challenge. I think it's kind of silly to assume that the pyramids we see today were... That's all to it. You know, there was nothing else inside. You know, there was a lot more stuff inside them. Yeah, and we know that for a fact because excavations, they document, you know, how things were removed. Certain blocks, you know, were removed and broken down and carried away. But even beyond that, there must have been, you know, something else in them to make them function as, you know, whatever we think it was.
You've proposed that they... knew about nuclear energy.
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple ideas, and one idea that popped into my head: if we are seriously, you know, considering a hypothesis that there was an advanced civilization back then, it is clear to me that such an advanced civilization would have mastered nuclear energy. You know, we've mastered it. So, and nuclear energy has a lot more power density than chemical energy. So gallon of, you know, gasoline is a pretty big chunk of fluid, right? So in terms of nuclear energy, it would be just a grain of sand that packs that much energy. So it's like 10,000 times, if not like million times higher power density than chemical power. So I do think if an ancient civilization existed, it would have used nuclear energy. And therefore, because I'm a nuclear scientist, I know what traces to look for. And that's why I'm very interested in going to Egypt and conducting on-site radiological surveys, because I'll be able to tell if there are any technogenic, you know, isotopes present on-site, be that, you know, pyramids or Serapium or anywhere else, because they have very, you know, characteristic spectra that I can detect.
And do you think you will find that?
I think I will find it if I'm allowed to go, but that's my hope. Of course, it could be I conduct the survey and all I see is natural radioactive background, because, you know, we are surrounded in the sea of natural radioactivity. You know, the radon gas seeps through the ground. You know, uranium and thorium is present in Earth crust. But, you know, we know how that looks like, so we can tell normal background apart from background that's been contaminated by some nuclear processes. And that's why I'm also very interested in collecting, you know, surface samples. And that's, you know, one thing I've done with Ben and with Matt Bell. So Ben brought some samples that I put in my electron microscopes, and we were looking for contaminants. Didn't find anything notable. Then I borrowed a bunch of vases from Matt Bell and was studying their radiological signature and using my germanium detectors. And initially I thought I was seeing something, but you know, later I realized that, you know, what I was seeing is the activity in thorium that's naturally found in minerals. And the most interesting observation I made at the Petrie Museum, so I took one of my detectors to the Petrie Museum and I captured radioactive background from it, and I noticed a lot of lead in that radiation. And I was excited about it initially because lead is a product of radioactive decay. Everything eventually decays down to lead or bismuth. You know, the decay chain is rather long, but let's say you start at uranium and then it decays, and it ends up with lead. So when you see a lot of lead, you know, a nuclear scientist inside me gets excited because that could have been the byproduct of decay. But later I learned that Egyptians were using coal as an eye shadow. And coal is based on galena, and galena is basically lead oxide. So what I was seeing is residual fluorescence, X-ray fluorescence, from coal that was stored in this jar, you know, at some time. You see what I mean?
You've done, what's the term, metrological studies on pre-dynastic Egyptian stone vessels. And
yes,
you've concluded, and I think it's fair to say that the technology that they would have used is on par, or if not better, than what we have today.
I can correct that qualification a little bit. So yes, I was instantly drawn to the idea that these pre-dynastic stone vessels are precisely and finely made for two reasons. You know, the pictures that Ben showed and other people showed, and some of the specimens that I've seen at museums, they do look like they were exceptionally well made. You know, they're round and nice and whatnot. And then I borrowed a few objects from Matt Bell collection and examined them personally, and they looked phenomenal. And Matt, to his credit, he commissioned CAT scanning, you know, which is X-rays. So he commissioned 3D scanning using X-rays of his entire collection, and he shared his scans with me, and I wrote some software to analyze those scans. And the first thing I've done, I've defined a quality metric. So whenever you want to examine how well something is made, you have to define what that, you know, well means. Like, we know when you build a house, a well-constructed house is plumb and square, for example, right? If you order a machine part at a machine shop, how well the part made is determined by tolerances. So you tell them, I need a disc that's 10 inches in diameter and 5 inches thick, and then, you know, they make of the disc and you measure it, and the deviation from that must be, you know, within the tolerances that you specify. So that's how we go about determining whether something is well made when it's like machined on an industrial scale. But in the case of this ancient artifacts, it was difficult to come up with a measure of, you know, goodness. And that's, you know, what I spent the effort on. And I said, okay, well, I am going to choose a metric of concentricity and circularity to evaluate how well, you know, the vessel is made. Because we don't know what the blueprint was, you know. There isn't like a blueprint, a papyrus, with the drawing, with the dimensional drawing of the vase, right, that we can measure against. But it's evidence that they were trying to make a round and symmetrical shape. And that's what I assumed. So the assumption is, you know, the artist or the machinist or whoever was making it, a reptilian alien maybe, I don't know, that they tried to produce a symmetrical and a round object. And that's, you know, the measure that I express mathematically in terms of, if I slice this 3D scan in circular slices, each slice will be characterized by a measure of circularity of how round it is. And overall, the slices will be characterized by how concentric they are, is, you know, how well do they line up on the same axis. And that's the software I developed, and I crunched through Matt Bell's scans, and it took me a while to comprehend you know, the results. It took me a year to complete the project, to be precise. So it was, you know, some serious effort on my part. And what I saw that the objects in Matt Bell's collection fall into two categories, the, you know, quote unquote precise, and the rest were like not precise. So when I plot the results, I get a chart, and that chart has like two areas where the objects congregate together. So one is at the bottom of the chart, I call it, you know, the precise group, and the rest of them are not precise. And then, of course, all scientific work is comparative in nature, in the sense that if you get a result, the result by itself does not mean anything. You need to compare it to something. So I took Matt Bell's collection and I compared it to a sample of modern vases. So I bought a bunch of vases on internet, like gift shop quality vases, made from different materials, from you know, alabaster and marble, all the way to granite. So you can buy, you know, granite vases, no problem. They are typically made for outdoor use, for funerals, for graves and things of that nature. But anyway, I bought, I don't know, 20, 30 of them, a lot, big sample, and I bought a scanner. So I scanned them to see how they stack up against Matt Bell collection. And I was surprised to see that all the modern vases I purchased, obviously, you know, they were made on a machine. They were turned on the lathe. You know, when you look at them, you see the tool marks. But all of them, you know, match the high precision, you know, vases from Matt Bell's collection. And I said, well, you know, that is interesting. But how do museum vases really look like? Because the problem with objects in private collections, you don't know the provenance. You don't know whether those objects are genuine or whether they are forgeries or fakes or replicas. And that's a well-known problem in Egyptology. I think as modern art aside, I think Egyptian artifacts are the most forged objects in human history. And the peak of the forgery was the dawn of the 20th century, because that's when, you know, Egyptian exploration really peaked and a bunch of, you know, prominent figures went down there and did their digs and reported their finds. And the interest was huge, so the artifacts were, you know, manufactured and sold left and right. And that's, you know, very well known and very well established facts with books and papers written about it. So that's kind of the problem dealing, you know, with private collectors. You don't know where those objects came from. There is no history. So it was important to me to go to a museum. So I went to the Petrie Museum in London, and I took my huge and heavy scanner with me, and I got a permission to scan about 20 of their objects. And I analyzed them also. And when I analyzed them and I plotted, you know, the museum objects on my chart, on my quality chart, and I was astonished to see that all of them clump in the same area that matches the quote-unquote unprecise area from Matt Bell's collection. So the conclusion of the museum visit was that there were no precise objects at the museum. Even when a vase, when a basalt vase looked exceptionally well made to an eye, when you scan it and when you analyze the skin, it's still consistent with the hand labor. And that was, you know, a disheartening result for me to realize, and it took me a while, you know, to process it and for everything to sink in, because the only conclusion that I can draw from this experience is that, you know, the so-called precise objects in private collections are of modern origin as opposed to of ancient origin. So I cannot really say when they were made, maybe, you know, this century, maybe last century. But their workmanship is inconsistent with the genuine ancient Egyptian artifacts that I've seen and scanned at the museum. You know, their workmanship, on the other hand, is 100% consistent with the, you know, modern machining technology. And that was, you know, the biggest takeaway from my research. And now I've published a paper on it at Nature Heritage Sciences that, you know, was just made public like a few weeks ago. where I report all of my findings. And one thing I'm also doing, I published all of my scans, you know, I published all of my source data so that, you know, anybody could go in and conduct their own analysis. You know, I disclosed how I, you know, wrote the code, how I calculated everything. So it's extremely transparent for anyone else to see and analyze. And in fact, Stina Gerdes, you know, she used this opportunity to independently examine my scans and independently, you know, verify my analytical technique. And she arrived at the same conclusion. She also used, you know, her own technique. So she has her own quality metrics that she derived. So she used both hers and mine, and the conclusions are similar. So we do believe now that the most precise vases that are privately owned are of modern origin, as opposed to of ancient Egyptian origin. And one more thing I'm going to add, ever since I visited Petrie Museum, you know, one more time, so I scanned another set of Fortin objects, and I went to Manchester Museum, where I scanned another, you know, 15 or so, and the results are the same. So I haven't seen like ultra precise vessel. And so when I report my findings, I say, I haven't seen all of the vases, right? So there are about 2,000 known stone vessels of pre-dynastic origin that's been cataloged. So there is actually a book, a couple of books written about them, and every vase has been cataloged. And so there are about like 2,000 of them or so. Of pre-dynastic, not like overall, but, you know, the ones that are attributed to pre-dynastic period. And when you even look at pictures of them, there is a website, you know, one guy put a catalog together, you know, they all look similar. And when you look at them for a while, you kind of start spotting imperfections. So they don't look as shiny or as symmetrical as the vases in, you know, private collections. So, once again, I haven't scanned all of them, but I have looked pretty much at majority of them. And, you know, I don't see any evidence of this space tech precision in them. And that's kind of the disheartening outcome of my research, that it took me a while to digest. And I know a lot of people are still disagreeing and arguing, and I do get a lot of hate about this result, with people saying, oh, I sold my soul to academia, or Zaki Hawass paid me, or, you know, Flynn Dibble paid me, or somebody else. But my answer is, no, that's how you conduct scientific research. You know, you speak your mind truthfully, you do your work honestly, and I will change my opinion, you know, if I find a vase with provenance that, you know, is traced to a tomb or to a known excavation, and if it possesses, you know, these unusual qualities consistent with modern machining, you know, that will change everything. You know, that will, you know, change history. But I haven't seen a vase like that.
But the pre-dynastic period was very, very long time ago, and you would expect chronologically those vases would be very primitive nonetheless.
You're partially correct, and that's another thing that I need to, I guess, correct, is when we speak about artifacts that have been, you know, produced in the past, they usually not just like one group of artifacts, but, you know, multiple groups of artifacts, because like in modern day, you know, back thousands of years ago, there were different tiers of quality. Like, you can go to Walmart and you can buy a handbag, right? Or you can go to a mall and buy a Louis Vuitton bag, right? And that those will be, you know, different quality tiers. You know, one is a luxury good, high quality, super expensive. The other is a, like, run-of-the-mill consumer item, you know, cheaply made, inexpensive. Cars are the same way. You can buy a supercar, Lamborghini, and you can marvel at how well it's made, or you can buy, you know, cheap Russian junker that barely drives. So prehistory was exactly the same way. They were goods that were made for the elite. And this is like very well established in the case of pre-dynastic stone vessels, because they are only found in the burials of royalty. So if you excavate a burial, and it's a royal burial, you will surely find, you know, a stone vessel in it. Whereas, you know, if you find a burial of a common man, you'll find like a clay pot or something like that. So these stone vessels, they were luxury goods. And their manufacturing quality was different from everything else. It's kind of like a Fabergé egg. You know, a Fabergé egg was, you know, such a fine thing made for the Tsar family that you wouldn't find like in a graveyard where common peasants were buried. So it's not surprising for me to see, you know, high quality of work, because it was a luxury item. You know, the question becomes, you know, why was it a luxury item? And I have a theory about it. But it's entirely explicable, you know, why it was well made, because it was made, you know, for a purpose. It was a luxury good that, for whatever reason, you know, Egyptians wanted. But if you would allow me to speculate, I would say that a lot of these basalt vases, they look like machine parts. And you're familiar with the cargo cult theory, right? When primitive people are emulating, you know, higher technology of visiting people, with the good illustration being when Americans dropped cargo on a Pacific island and the natives have never been in contact with, you know, advanced people. So they treated Americans as gods and they started emulating, you know, the earphones and the building, you know, strong stick airplanes. And even, you know, conducting the drills just like the Americans did. So it's an excellent illustration of how, you know, rituals and religion and imitations develop. So when I look at some of this, you know, pre-dynastic basalt vessels, what strikes me, odd, you know, why choose basalt? Because basalt is black. It's not particularly pretty stone. But it does look like, you know, anodized steel a lot. And some of the vases, they look more like, what's the term? Like machine parts. Like if you take a machine apart, like industrial machine, there will be these, you know, black cylindrical parts with flanges. And some of the, you know, pre-dynastic vases look that way. So if I am allowed to speculate, I would say that, you know, pre-dynastic Egyptians were in touch or in contact with an advanced civilization, and they saw some of their artifacts. And they wanted to emulate them. And basalt stone, you know, was the closest thing they could find to anodized steel. And then they shaped and machined, you know, those vessels and vases according to the memory of these strange objects that they've seen. And that's why we have this flanged and cylindrical shapes. And because those original objects were associated with gods, I think royalty wanted to have a piece of God, you know, with them. And that's why, you know, they were made, you know, for the royalty, because everybody wanted to say, oh yeah, you know, your great-great-grandfather walked with gods. So here is the artifact. So that's, you know, my speculative theory that, you know, kind of makes sense to me. But I do think that, you know, the quality of workmanship is entirely explicable with the grinding. And the grinding technology they used was not primitive by any stretch of imagination. It was very ingenious. And that's what we got to understand about ancient people. It's incorrect to view them as primitive savages, because they were not. You know, granted, some tribes were primitive savages, just like in modern days. You go to Africa or to Amazon and you find people that still run naked, you know, with a spear. But it doesn't mean everyone is like that. So in prehistory, this was more the case. There were a lot more wild tribes compared to, let's call it, you know, civilized tribes, or they're called cultures in archaeology. So in Egyptian prehistory, there were probably more wild, uncivilized tribes than there were civilized. But the civilized tribes that built the kingdom, you know, they were developed. They were not, you know, primitive. They were not savages. And we know few things about them. We don't know everything, but where the pre-dynastic period ends and the dynastic period begins, it's basically, a unification of Egypt, meaning each northern and southern portions, or upper and lower of Egypt, you know, were countries in their own rights. They just, you know, unified, became one state. And their cultures and industrial techniques merged, but each was developed. It wasn't like two undeveloped pieces came together. We're talking like two developed pieces joining and counting common history starting from them, from that moment on.
What about excess thorium-232?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So when I conducted measurements on the samples, it appeared to me that there was an excess of thorium-232. Later, because I published that work on my website, I was approached by a geologist. And the geologist pointed out to a systematic flaw in my measurements. And that's a thing what's the word? Every measurement has a quirk to it. So the way I was conducting my radiological survey of the Matt Bell's vessels did not properly account for the geometry of the vessel and how it was positioned with respect to the detector. So I thought it was unimportant. I thought, you know, let's say here is the vessel and here is the detector and this is good. And what the geologist explained to me is different vessels have different quantity of material. So bigger vessel would have more rock in it than a smaller one. And that matters. The vessel shape matters too. And how you position the vessel with respect to the detector affects your readings. You know, I knew all of that. I just underestimated the effect. I thought the effect would be small. And he told me, no, the effect would be large. And what you need to do properly is to buy a special kind of software that, you know, conveyor cells, where you input the 3D model of the object, you input the characteristics of the detector, and you basically recreate, you know, your measurement setup. So here's your pot, here's your detector. And this is the properties of the detector you used. And it will compensate for geometry, will compensate for the difference in mass, compensate for the difference of orientation, and will give you a result that's proper. And he was pretty sure that the difference in peak height I got was because of that. And I tend to agree with him. I never got to buy the software though, because it's like $3,000. Another, you know, $3,000 I got to spend. And so I kind of left it at that. So the conclusion was incorrect. It wasn't an excess of thorium. It was just an error in measurement methodology. And that's, you know, a common thing in science, unfortunately. Taking accurate measurements is difficult. So there isn't an excess of thorium-232, unfortunately.
Other than this being a fascinating topic, what are the implications?
Oh boy. I mean, obviously, I think where I agree with, let's say, people on YouTube or alternative historians and archaeologists, I think our past is a lot more fascinating and a lot more interesting than, let's say, the mainstream version of it would make us believe. So I think, you know, this talk about Atlantis and aliens or ancient gods or extraterrestrial gods, I don't think it's just talk. I take it seriously because, you know, to me, every hypothesis is worth testing. And I don't care whether it sounds crazy. In fact, I like it to sound crazy because then it's interesting to explore. It's never interesting to explore like a boring topic. It's interesting to look for, you know, ancient reptilian beings and maybe find a sarcophagus, you know, with bones of them. That's like really cool. So I don't understand why scientists aren't so interested in doing it. Well, I know the reasons, but it's another story. Anyway.
Money.
I think, you know, money. Well, yes, obviously money, of course, corrupts everything. So the short answer is there is more. I think there is more to our past than, you know, we're led to believe. And I think the reason we want to know the truth about the past is because it helps us understand, you know, the present better and navigate through present, you know, with the knowledge that's more accurate. And, you know, one implication is if, you know, like Chris Dunn and Dan Van Kerkhove say that the history is cyclical, it very well might be. So, you know, are we at the end of our cycle? Or when that end might come, you know, can we do anything about it? You know, should we do anything about it? Or maybe it's cyclical for a reason. Yeah. Like religious people, like Christians, believe in the judgment day. And what is a judgment day? It's the end of the cycle, right? So everything is wiped and the worthy are saved and, you know, life goes on, but in a different realm. You know, maybe that's how is nature structured, and maybe that's what we want to find out. You know, the idea of cyclical history, you know, does appeal to me immensely. And, you know, I have my own hypothesis on how that, you know, might come into being. And I do believe that Arctic, like Greenland ice sheet and Antarctic ice sheet play an important role because they kind of pin Earth's crust to mantle, because this is enormous weight. And it's not a controversial fact or anything. Geologists are well aware that the crust of Earth under Antarctic has been like pushed down by the weight of ice. So it, you know, the ice, there's a lot of ice, it really weighs down on it. It really pins Earth's crust to the mantle. And then, you know, some other scientists, I forget his name now, back in the 50s or 60s, I think, put forth a hypothesis that the Earth crust might slip. And when it slips, you know, you'll have this enormous tidal wave that goes on and, you know, washes everything. And you don't like need like a total slip. You just need like a hiccup because there is a lot of inertia in the rotation of the Earth. So you have like a tiny hiccup, and all of a sudden, like for a fraction of a second or for a second, you know, the crust isn't spinning at the same rate as the rest of the planet. You'll have this, you know, enormous tidal wave of the ocean, you know, rolling across the landmass and wiping everything clean. And when you look at Google photos on Earth, you know, you find evidence of a massive flood. Even Joe Rogan, you know, noticed when he was looking at the map of Sahara. You know, there is evidence of, you know, giant flows that, you know, would be explicable by an ocean or a tidal wave, you know, going and wiping everything. So it's not out of the realm of impossible, especially in view of recent publications where scientists claim that the Earth's core experiencing like irregularity in rotation. So if that is possible, you know, then maybe crust too, you know, may slip, especially if another celestial body, maybe like a stray comet or a wandering star, a wandering planet is coming nearby and Earth is experiencing an unusual like, gravitational pull of this interloper that's traveling through the solar system, kind of like, you know, through iAtlas we've experienced. Maybe that is the trigger. But I think the real trigger is if you have an advanced civilization, then it will inevitably result in the buildup of CO2 in the atmosphere. And then all of your extra ice will melt. And there is nothing pinning the Earth's crust to the mantle anymore. And therefore, this external event that might trigger the crust slippage becomes potentially more potent because previously the ice was a safeguard. It was keeping safe because it was pushing the crust down, and now we've melted the ice, the safeguard is gone, and maybe this comet or asteroid or planet that's passing by through the solar system periodically, maybe like Sitchin hypothesized, creates enough of gravitational influence to where the Earth's crust spins or skips a bit and the tidal wave rolls over and we start fresh. You know, that's kind of the idea that's appealing to me, and I think I see some evidence of that, like here in Florida.
Max, who do you think the pre-dynastic Egyptians were?
Good question. I don't really know. I think it's pretty much, you know, the same people who inhabit, you know, Egypt now. I'm not aware of any like migrations or extinctions that took place. So I can only uninformedly say that I do believe it's the same people that inhabit Egypt now, but I don't really know. I don't think they were special in that sense. Like, you know, Paracas people in Peru were special because of their elongated skulls and their red hair. But to my knowledge, pre-dynastic Egyptians aren't particularly special for the region.
No, well, the reason why I'm asking is because you were mentioning the potential parallel of an advanced civilization influencing them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I would say that the idea that appeals to me is the idea that there has been a visitation in the past, either like an ancient alien hypothesis or extraterrestrial, you know, visitors interacted with the ancient Egyptians or maybe people who inhabited the region before them. But I think, you know, they came, visited, and they're gone. I think they truly left this place because every myth on this planet goes like this. Gods came from heaven, you know, they taught people agriculture, taught people metalwork, this and that, and then they left. And ever since, we're waiting for their return. You know, the story of Jesus is kind of the same, right? He came, got crucified, left, and we're waiting for his return. So why is this, you know, same story? Came and left and were waiting for their return. So I think because that's what really happened. So they visited, they taught us stuff, and then they left. They're not here anymore. And that's why it's difficult to reconcile this seemingly high-tech things or imitations of high-tech with what you would expect from primitive people just because they got exposure to something they shouldn't have. And that's what makes it confusing, because I think mainstream archaeology is trying to explain it in terms of, oh, it's just, you know, primitive stuff. And where you say, no, it is high tech. Well, in fact, it's both. It's an imitation of high tech, you know, with primitive tools, primitive technology. It's cargo cult, you know, that's what I believe it is.
So what's the moral of the story? Is it to realize that we have a completely impoverished understanding of history and that we should approach it with nuance?
Yes, I think the moral of the story, I would have like two outcomes, you know, one for academic scientists and one for amateur scientists. So what I really would like to see in academic science is to take the amateur ideas seriously. In fact, if we have a publicly funded science, I think publicly funded science is obligated to address public interest. And the public interest is we want to explore these wild ideas. You know, we want to look for ancient aliens. We want to look for Atlantis. We want to look for this, you know, crazy, fascinating stuff. And who can blame us, the public? And if this is our interest, you know, darn. This is what you ought to be doing. You know, put on your Indiana Jones hat and go dig, you know, look for alien bones, look for buried flying saucers, because that's what we really want, you know, mainstream scientists to do. And if they've done it, I think it would be no problem finding funding for science, because everybody, you know, wants that done. But it's not happening, unfortunately, and, you know, most academic science tend to dismiss and laugh at the ideas that we discuss here, and so it's not happening. At the same time, you know, my message to the, you know, amateur researchers and alternative researchers is, you know, research is a difficult process, and research amounts to reading literature. So if you want to speak of pyramids with authority, you know, do bother to read the available scientific literature on the topic, because you'll learn a lot. You know, people studied it for hundreds of years, for thousands of years, you know, going back to Herodotus, you know, the first officially recognized historian. So you got to study all of that because there is a lot of said and written. And then, you know, if you conduct experiments, you got to learn your protocols. You got to learn how to measure. And you got to present your findings truthfully and you got to publish them. So everybody, you know, could critique your findings. And that's, you know, the only way we can make progress. In fact, if I am allowed to draw a historical parallel, in the past, all science was conducted by amateurs. There was no such thing as professional scientists or academic scientists. You know, Newton had a job, so science was a hobby to him. Even Einstein had a job as a patent clerk when he developed his special theory of relativity and published a paper on the photo effect. So for hundreds of years, basically until recently, science was conducted by amateurs. And the only reason we made progress is because, you know, those amateurs were true scientists. You know, they conducted their work diligently, they reported their findings truthfully, and they published their results. And that's why when the next person comes in, he reads what the previous person wrote and builds on that. And that's, you know, an important process that we must maintain. It's not enough just to sit and talk and bullshit. At the end of the day, you know, we need to write something. And we need to write something, you know, publish it, because by writing it, you are sharing the knowledge. You are pushing the knowledge forward. You're allowing others to read your writing and build and improve upon it. So that's my message.
But I mean, one of the major issues with amateur science is that they just don't have the funding. So it would take them 10, 20, 30 times longer to research.
That is correct. I am an amateur scientist myself. I don't have the funding. You know, Newton was a scientist. He didn't have the funding. I think that's the truth about science. We don't need too much money. You know, we need some, but we don't need too much. We don't need like hundreds of thousands of dollars. And where is curiosity? There is always a way. You know, I found money somehow. I mean, I chose to spend my money because that's what scientists do. You know, Newton spent his money. Einstein spent his money. Everybody, you know, Ampere, you know, Volta spent their money. That's what we do when we really want to know. You know, you're not waiting for somebody to give you a handout. You know, your curiosity just, you know, wouldn't let you sleep. And you say, heck, you know, I don't have to buy a new car this year. My car is fine. How about I use this money, you know, to go to Egypt or buy some equipment or conduct some measurements? So yeah, it will take money, it will take time, and that's why it took 300 years to develop a theory of electrodynamics. Because every scientist, you know, did a little bit of work, and in the end, you know, 300 years later, we have Maxwell's equations. And I think this is about the only way to conduct science. Because, you know, money corrupts everything. And if you throw too much money into the process, it becomes about money. It ceases being about the truth. It ceases being about fact-finding. It becomes, oh, I have PhDs that I need to employ. Oh, I have, you know, lab technicians that I need to employ. Oh, I have, you know, grant sponsors that I need to report to because I want to get another grant. So it becomes about money. So that's why I'm actually conducting my research in public domain, and you know, if you would like to donate or contribute, I'll take a donation, but we don't need a lot of money to fund this. You know, it's just, you know, the time and the money that we can commit to it that makes the difference.
Okay, well, where can my audience go?
Yes, my website is maximus.energy, and if you go there, you'll find my blog on ancient Egypt, and that's where I post my findings, and that's, you know, where I solicit donations when I need them, and this is where I report my results. So maximus.energy is, you know, the website I encourage you to visit, and of course, you can leave your comment there, and you can critique my work. I'm always happy to hear constructive criticism. If you find a flaw or suggest an improvement, I'd like to hear it because I don't know everything and, of course, I could be mistaken. That's kind of the whole point of publication peer review. I'd like to know what you think. I could be full of shit. You tell me.
All right, well, Dr. Max Zamolov, Thank you for joining me in the trenches.